The Vintage Gamer, Episode 10, GDC Report, Number 2.
Hello, this is Jim Van Verth for The Vintage Gamer. I'm here recording the second of the two episodes, sort of wrapping up my GDC trip here. Overall, it was a really, really good trip. I had probably the best time I've had in years. Of course, the past 2 years, I lost my voice, so I really wasn't terribly social, and I got sick 2 years ago. So this year was just plain great. I had a great time chatting with people, catching up with people in the industry, making new contacts. And that's really what GDC is all about. I mean, yes, there are the talks and all of that, learning new things, but it's also really good to go around and meet new people. So I have tried to break down this particular report into a few pieces here, trying to appeal to all of the people who listen to this podcast. So we have some RPG content, very small, board game content, a little bigger, and of course some computer gaming content. So, as I said, the RPG content is rather small. It actually has not existed. I was hoping to try and get an interview with Greg Kostikian, but I saw him twice during the conference, and that was in passing. He was deep in conversation with somebody else. I didn't feel like I could just burst in and interrupt him. But he was there, and hopefully I'll try and develop a little better. Try and contact him before the conference and set something up next time. Also saw Steve Jackson wandering around, and again, just really wasn't a good time to try and talk with him. I did have a nice conversation with Carl Schnurr, who was somebody who worked on Ars Magica 3 and 4, and a few modules for that RPG system. He and I had a pretty good conversation about, you know, computer game industry. And here's why I tease you and say, of course I didn't record it, because I didn't have the recorder with me. That was a moment lost, unfortunately. So that is the meager and somewhat unappetizing RPG content. But board game content, I actually have something here. First of all, I went and visited probably the Eurogamer's Nightmare. It's the world's largest Monopoly board, which is right there in downtown San Jose, near the Children's Discovery Museum and the Hilton Hotel. I have some pictures, which I'll throw up on the website. I'm sure that it has to be on Board Game Geek. I kept forgetting to check to see if it's there. And if it's not on Board Game Geek, I'll throw pictures of it up there, too. But the big one is the massively multiplayer board game that I talked about the last time, called Pantheon. And I thought I'd give a quick rundown how that game worked. Basically, it was a four-team game. The four colors, red, yellow, blue, and green. And the way it worked is that you get a game card, which has a virgin on it. Sorry, has a virgin sticker and two follower stickers. You use a virgin by placing it into a chart, which is representing a volcano. And as your team gets more and more virgins in their volcano, the team gets to use different special abilities and place different kinds of pieces on the board. Now, the objective is to take over areas called Holy Lands. And for each Holy Land where you have majority support, you get 1 point. And ties, each team gets 1 point. You get to these Holy Lands by placing followers and other pieces. And followers begin at a divine gate, which of course is nowhere near a particular Holy Land. And then you build a chain of followers across the land until you get to a Holy Land, and you can fill it in with your followers or other pieces. Now, the land has different types of terrain, and there are different types of followers that go over those different types of terrain. So there's forest, mountain, desert, and sea. And, of course, the different maps have varying types of terrain. So one map had a lot of sea spaces, so if you ended up with a lot of sea pieces, you could go there and place a lot of pieces. Or, if you know, these other maps have more mountains, and you can use your mountain pieces there. And there were 5 different boards spread across the conference center, and you could choose which board you would play on depending on what pieces that you were assigned. The way you get pieces is that every 2 hours or so, you could show back up at the main central area for the game, and they would give you two new random pieces. And those pieces, as I said, those pieces are just those basic followers. Now, based on the special abilities that your team has, you can upgrade those followers into better pieces. So there are things like Priest, which can go anywhere, including a new type of terrain, a different kind of terrain called a Burning Land, just a very desert area. Sorry, beyond the desert, just a very hot area. There are Fanatics, which can jump over spaces and continue to chain that way. Guardians, which can be placed anywhere and can actually resurrect killed followers. Now, followers are killed by soldiers, which is another special piece. And you place that, and you just say, this follower's dead, and the proctor at that particular board will place an X on top of that piece. And sort of the upgrade from here, soldiers are heroes, which occupy... The soldiers only occupy basic terrain, and the heroes will occupy the burning lands as well. And then avatars can actually take over other followers. So instead of killing the other person's follower, you replace it with your team's. The game was... I think the game would have been more interesting if it had been a little more balanced in terms of how the players were distributed. In theory, it's supposed to be randomly distributed, but it really wasn't equally randomly distributed. Perhaps I'm just grousing because I wasn't on the green team. But the green team seemed to have, I'm not sure, maybe even twice as many players as at least the team I was on, which was the yellow team. And it was... they clearly had the advantage from the beginning, and they won the game handily just because of that. I mean, because of that, they had more... Because of the more people they had on the team, it meant they have more special abilities. So there were three columns of special abilities. I have a picture of this, which again I'll put up so you can see it. But sorry about that. So you could, so they filled up two of the columns, whereas other teams basically filled up one. So they had more special abilities, and of course they had more people, which means they had more opportunities to place pieces on the board. I think if the game had been a little more balanced, I think it would have been a lot more fun for everyone. But even so, yellow team on Friday tried their best to take out green. We got a large group of people working together at one point trying to cut off green's supply line. That's another part I forgot to mention, is that if you have a supply line from a holy land back to Divine Gate, your starting point, then you get one extra point for that as well. So we basically cut off their supply chain because they had this very long, thin supply line going all the way across the board, and then they spread out to fill out the holy gate. And we cut that off at the beginning and cut off half their points, essentially. But again, they still won the game, but yellow came in second. They did quite well. It was a fun game. Good excuse for interacting with people. I see here, I'm looking at the rule sheet, which I'll try to scan in and throw up on the site as well. There were also three miracles that you could place down, and the miracles change the type of terrain that's under them. So you could change terrain to a plains, which means you can place any piece there. Unholy thorns, which means you can't place any piece there, or a divine gate, which allows you to generate more followers from that area. I don't think anybody ever got to the point where they could generate divine gates. I didn't see that at all. There weren't quite enough people playing the game. So that's basically Pantheon, and as I said, I'll have pictures of the game boards, the final scores, and I'll try and get the rule sheet up there too, so you can actually see what the game is all about. So that's the board game content, and now, of course, the computer game content. As I mentioned in the first sort of episode of this, I went to a number of technical sessions in the first few days. However, in the latter half of Thursday and Friday, I went to some sessions that weren't quite so technical, so I'll try to talk about some of those here. The first of those was something on prototyping, which was presented by one of the people who's working on Spore. If you're listening to Gaming Steve's podcast, and if you're interested in GDC, you should be listening to Gaming Steve's podcast. That's gamingsteve.com. You probably have heard about Spore already, and I've mentioned it a little bit myself. But this game is really about building little mini games, and they talked about the prototyping process that they went through to develop these mini games, build up this large hole, as it were. I think the most interesting thing that I got out of that was the presenter, whose name I do not have noun here, I'm very sorry, talked about breaking the prototyping process into exploring different axes of games. In his case, he had game mechanics, kinesthetics, which is basically how the controls feel, aesthetics, which is how the game looks, you know, is it pleasing to the eye and that, and then technology, just the general game engine type stuff, physics, graphics, that sort of thing. And the idea of the prototype is that you pick one of these axes and you try to explore that as much as possible while not trying to do too much on the other axes. And that way you are restricting the goals of your prototype as much as possible. I think that's a very interesting idea. I'm wondering if you could actually do that with board games as well. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, with board games, you're really working on mechanics, and maybe you're working on theme as well, so that would give you two axes to explore. So you could work on the mechanics separately, not worry about theme, and then try to explore the theme after that, which, as I understand it, is the way that game designers work. They pick one of those axes, explore in that direction, and then they work on filling out the other one, which is sometimes why you end up with games that are very tight mechanically but feel somewhat themeless. And then you have themed games which, you know, don't really have a good, smooth mechanic to them. And let's see. After that, I actually went to that talk so that I could go to the Gamer's Rant. Last year's Gamer's Rant consisted of gamers standing up, well-known gamers standing up and saying, you know, our industry is in big trouble. They used other words that I can't use because I'm trying to keep this as a clean podcast. Yes, they had four letters and they began with F. There actually were four main people ranting and then a couple of guest people. The first guest was a woman whose name I'm afraid I didn't catch. I'm very sorry. But she ranted about the cheesecake that was placed around the halls of GDC. It's an advertisement for a series of books which featured digital art, and most of them consisted of scantily clad women. I tend to agree with her. It really wasn't appropriate, particularly when we're trying to get women to actually get more involved in the game industry in terms of developing and playing games. So it just seemed a little tasteless and out of place. In any case, there were some good pictures there, but most of them did not involve naked women. And then Frank Lance got up, and his rant was fairly mild. Actually, most of the rants were fairly mild. He said his rant was about how games are trying to represent life too much. That we actually need a deliberate gap between a representation and reality. And as we try to narrow that gap further and further, well, we sort of lose the purpose of games. I mean, games are an abstraction of reality. So immersion really shouldn't be our ultimate goal. Ultimately, our goal should be to provide good gameplay. Which is the following on to the rant last year, which is people saying that, you know, where are the innovative games? So he's trying to say, let's encourage the innovation in gameplay rather than trying to simply push on the technology and make, you know, the physics as accurate as possible and make the graphics look as accurate as possible. And even, I guess, make the AI act exactly like a human being as well. The second official rant was by Seamus Blackley, who worked on Trespasser, and also in the development of the original Xbox. And he was basically saying that the industry was euphemizing themselves. Insert appropriate word here. He was saying that if we only go for an artistic vision, then that really doesn't necessarily pay the bills. You really need to combine an artistic vision with a vision on how to sell that to people. And if it's simply a work of beautiful art and you don't find a business model for it, then an investor has no reason to invest in that product and try to bring it to market. I mean, he said he is now an executive. I think he's working for the CAA. And he's, as one of these people in the suits, someone brings this vision in, and these guys in the suits are just scared of losing their jobs. They're scared that they're going to make a bad decision, and it's going to cost them millions of dollars, and it's all going to go down the toilet, and they're going to get fired. And the artistic person who brought it to them isn't going to get fired. They'll have a failure on their hands, and maybe it'll be more difficult for them to get money next time, but they're not going to lose their job. So his point was to say that you need to understand where these poor people were. I'm not saying that all executives are poor people, obviously, his point of view, but in any case, understand what their perspective is and make sure that when you're making innovative games that you have also think of a way to make money from those games, how to sell them. And even if it's just, look, I'm going to go to GDC and talk about this innovative game over and over and over and over again until people really want to buy it. Like, well, say, Spore. He also said that the industry really needs a business justification for these games. So, like, the film industry has the Oscars. And in the Oscars, you can reward, in theory, innovative movies. So the studio execs can say, all right, well, this movie is not going to make a lot of money, necessarily, but it will win us an award, which, you know, builds cachet for the studio, which, you know, allows us to do other projects. You know, we can say, we are an artistic studio, and come see our new artistic movie and put out some less artistic ones just to pay the bills. After him came Jonathan Blow, and he was saying, I mean, a lot of these are responses to last year's rant, which, as I said, was about lack of innovation in the industry. He was saying that maybe we should consider that innovation is a limited resource, like oil, and that we should really consider it a new model and how to sustain games without this innovation. Let's just assume that we're going to run out of innovation, that we've done everything that we're going to do, and it's just going to trail off, and we're going to have just nothing new is going to be seen under the sun. And his idea was to try to make games address the human condition. So his example was the Ultima 4, the morality system in that game, where you try to build up scores in different areas of morality. And in the end, you have to answer some questions about, you know, how moral you are as a character in order to win, instead of fighting the big boss. And so he's saying no other game has really used this system. So instead of trying to innovate a brand new system, why not just take this old innovative system and bring it up again? I mean, like, movies are oftentimes tell the same story over and over and over again. I believe Gladiator, which won so many awards, was very similar to a movie that was made, well, I'm not going to say what decade, maybe the 50s, 40s. But it practically told the same story of a gladiator who fought Commodus and defeated him in the arena. Probably the most contentious rant in terms of the audience was from Chris Crawford, and he basically just said the games industry is dead. Give up on it. It's brain dead. There's no creative life. basically EA is Procter & Gamble. It's just pushing out a product and just give up in games because interactive storytelling is the future. And later on, when it was question time, a lot of people had problems with that, obviously. I mean, they're in the games industry. And really want to nail him down on semantics and what he meant by that. I can only assume that he... I think that Chris Hecker makes the point a little bit better later, so when I get to Chris Hecker's rant, I'll discuss that. And finally, the last official person was supposed to be Jessica Mulligan, but instead they got one of the founders of Game Girls, Jane... Again, I'm sorry, I didn't catch her name. But she actually wrapped it all up quite nicely by saying that, you know, instead of just ranting, we should just... Instead of ranting, we should actually try to do something about changing these things. You know, she was saying, instead of, you know, ranting about bad gaming journalism, well, then let's figure out what's really wrong and try to fix it. So maybe we need to get more access to developers in the press. Maybe we need more blogs that are direct from developers. You know, maybe we need to start interviewing artists instead of just programmers and designers and producers. You know, try to improve the quality of the gaming journalism in that sense. And finally, the whole thing wrapped up with Chris Hecker, who basically, he was repeating his awards acceptance from the previous night. And his original notion was to rant. And then he said that, you know, which of course caused a titter in the audience. And then he said, no, I'm actually going to rave because games are really cool. And this is a new art form and we should really be excited because we're here. We're the beginning of the birth of a new art form. It's like being part of the movies back in the early teens and 20s. And but one thing we need to be careful of is to avoid the traps of other new media. So instead of being like comics, where they got ghettoized because they decided to follow just one paradigm of superheroes because it was easy, we need to be more like film, which explored different genres, and so wasn't placed in the ghetto and could actually be considered as an art form because it explored the broad spectrum of the human condition. And of course, I guess that goes back to John Blow's idea of let's do more with games than just you know, fighting the boss at the end. And I'm guessing here that he's sort of drawing the connection between superheroes and the first-person shooter. It's very easy to make a first-person shooter. It's easy to make a game where you run around and shoot people. Okay. It's not that easy, but you get the sense that it's easy to come up with a game design for that. Much easier than trying to come up with a game design for a game that explores the human condition. But by doing so, we risk ghettoizing the industry. And that's basically the rant. As a clarification on Chris Crawford's thing, while he was being challenged on that whole thing, he was basically following the Chris Hecker idea, saying that, look, games and comics are sort of one grouping, and I think he's implying that, you know, those are all childish things, very, very one or two dimensional, whereas novels and movies and his idea of interactive storytelling are another, that we're trying to explore a deeper and more richer experience with that. I just leave it out there for you to think about. I honestly don't know what he means by interactive storytelling, so I can't comment on it. And maybe I will in a later podcast when I do a little research and find out what he exactly means by that. And I think that's about it. Let's see, I've got some things. There was another prototype talk from Half-Life 2, talking about how they prototyped their physical gameplay. Just I'll briefly talk about how they created the gravity gun. Originally, they had what was called a glue gun, and you could shoot out glue, and it would, you know, you could pull objects towards you with this string of glue, and then you could glue objects together, and you could stick objects to the wall and sort of climb up the wall, you know, build this ladder for yourself. And it was kind of cool, but it didn't really fit into the standard shoot 'em up gameplay of Half-Life 2, and also the puzzle gameplay as well. And so that was changed to the gravity gun, which, again, allowed you to use it as a weapon and as part of the puzzle play as well. So it really fit better into their paradigm. The other advantage of that is that the glue gun was... It had problems in terms of building levels, because now the level designers have to build tops on things. You know, if you had a wall, and maybe you didn't, you know, normally the character couldn't go up, see over the wall, why build the top? Now you had to build the top, and you had to build a walkable surface on top of there, and it actually complicated the level design process too much. So they had to do that. And I think... Yep. After that, I basically went to technical talks. I'm thinking I might actually podcast the technical talks, but I'll probably do that on my Essential Math website instead, because that's more a technical website than this podcast, which is more about games and game design. So, if you're interested, drop me an email, and if I get enough people, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll do it anyway, just for the fun of it. So that's it. Not bad. Not quite half an hour here. So thank you for listening to The Vintage Gamer. And next week we'll actually go back to the old vintage gaming content. See you then.